is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
Ukraine crisis. The Russians have fired senior commanders, according to the London Times. Russia has fired senior commanders for their poor performance, quote, during the invasion of Ukraine. Cover-ups and scapegoating is the culture, according to British intelligence. Lieutenant General Serhii Kisel, commanding the elite 1st Tank Army, Guards Tank Army, has been suspended for his failure to capture Kharkiv. Also, officials believe Vice Admiral Igor Osipov, commanding the Black Sea Fleet, suspended for the sinking of the Moskva. Valery Gerasimov, chief of the general staff, is reported in place and enjoys the confidence of President Putin. However, earlier, the British intelligence agents reported that Gerasimov and Putin are making low-level tactical decisions, those usually associated with colonel or brigadier. What does this mean? I welcome Colonel Jeff McCausland, United States Army retired. He is CBS News. He is Dickinson College. He is the CEO of Diamond Six Leadership and Strategy. Jeff, the morale story has always been with us about the Russian ability to fight and to sustain offensive. How do you interpret these very public firings? British intelligence is clearly telling us something that everyone knows. What does this mean about the Russian ability now, 8 weeks, 9 weeks, 10 weeks into the war? Good evening to you.
John, good evening to you. I think it's indicative of what has been a really wholesale failure by the Russian military in the offensive. We have to remember, of course, they failed in the initial assault on Kyiv, which everyone expected they'd take in a couple of days. Then there was the disaster of the Moskva, the Black Sea Fleet, which was not only a disaster in losing that particular ship, but indicates their inability to defend themselves, and now has made the Black Sea Fleet relatively insignificant, I would argue, in many ways in the ongoing conflict in terms of being able to do any kind of amphibious operations, though they still can launch some cruise missiles from submarines, but much farther out to sea. And then thirdly, the vaunted Russian offensive into the Donbass following the failure of taking Kyiv around Kharkiv, the second largest city. And despite all their efforts, that offensive now too seems to have failed. And as a consequence, Putin and Gerasimov, Shoigu, are looking for scapegoats, people to blame for this particular disaster. Of course, in addition to these indicative failures at Kharkiv and in the Black Sea, John, we have estimates of in excess of 15,000 Russian soldiers killed in action, probably 30,000 or more wounded. So roughly a quarter of the initial force that advanced into Ukraine on the 24th of February is now dead or wounded and therefore combat ineffective. Any way you look at this, one would have to surmise this has been nearly a military disaster for the Russian Federation, and the political leadership is now looking for fall guys as this moves on.
I want to concentrate on this general from the elite 1st Guards Tank Army. Guards, I understand from the Soviet days and from the Second War, is something that is awarded to a regiment or a unit when it's understood as superior. It's a medal, and it also means you become the elite. You lead offensives. You are the defenders of choice of the Soviet and now Russian high command. Relieving the 1st Tank Army suggests that we have to now deal with what kind of battle this has become, Jeff. No longer fast moving. We have not seen reports of movement along the front outside of Kharkiv to Izum, south to Donetsk and Luhansk. We've not seen significant movement by the Russians for some time. We've seen reports, who knows, fog of war, of Ukrainians advancing. And we've discussed over these weeks that this is turning into an artillery war, a big gun club. You tell me that the U.S. and its allies are providing weapons and systems that are superior and likely to make the battle very much a lean towards Ukraine and away from Russia. What kind of weapons and how do they work, Jeff?
What they're providing, John, is the 155 millimeter howitzer. The United States has provided 90 of those and roughly 200,000 total rounds of 155 millimeter ammunition. At the same time, some of our NATO allies, Germans, Canadians, French, and others, have provided 155 millimeter guns as well. I've been doing some research. The best of my understanding, the ammunition provided by the United States will work in those other European guns, though they're slightly different in the calculation of firing data will have to be adjusted. But one has to keep in mind what we're providing them is an artillery system. It's not just the gun and the associated ammo. It's the ability to acquire targets using either the drones or using counter-battery radar systems, processing the targets in terms of deciding the priority at this moment on which targets you go after, then the calculation of firing data, and then the actual firing of a weapon to engage targets. So we've got to educate them and train them on that system. We've given them the parts, but how you pull it all together is key. Demands a certain degree of a more decentralized command structure, which the Ukrainians seem to have. Russians do not. But we've seen this with devastating effect in the last few days. And that was, again, this disastrous Russian battalion tactical group trying to cross a river on a pontoon bridge, which was literally destroyed. Some believe maybe as many as 1,000 Russian soldiers were killed or wounded. And literally, you know, perhaps as many as 100 Russian tanks were destroyed in that one engagement, most of which was probably artillery and drones.
Jeff, artillery war, standoff, battling each other without being able to see each other. Does that mean this war is turning into something like the static front of the first war, where the big guns dominated the story, and rarely after 16 were there major offensives on the ground?
Yeah, I fear that's what's exactly happening, John. I mean, the Ukrainians themselves in the last few days in the defense ministry have said we're entering a new phase of this particular war that's going to be a lot more static. The Russian offensives have failed. Their desire for speed of movement has failed. Now they're falling back on artillery, which has always been a weapon of choice for the Soviet and then the Russian military. NATO officials have already said in the last couple of days that they expect this particular front not to shift dramatically in the next few weeks as things move on. So what we're seeing, John, is a contest of will and a contest of logistics. My read right now is the Ukrainians are getting better based on the resupply being provided by the West and associated training. And the Russians are having more and more problems based on their difficulty with resupply for whatever reason, which does not seem to be dramatically improving. And of course, the casualty rates that they have suffered, raising the question of available manpower.
You've instructed me, logistics win wars. Do the Ukrainian forces have the logistics to keep the equipment coming to the front line, especially the artillery shells, traveling from Lviv all the way across the country?
Well, so far, at least, they seem to be doing so. And it's odd the Russians have not, I think, mounted a serious effort to interrupt that supply movement. They have not interdicted supply chains. They have not made a concentrated effort to destroy the railway network across Ukraine, which is extensive, and they're very dependent, the Ukrainians, on that for moving such things as artillery ammo, which comes in large, heavy quantities. But they're concerned, and I've talked to leaders in Kyiv about the West's continued willingness to provide the military equipment they desire. They were a little concerned when the Congress, for example, slowed down on the passage of this upcoming $40 billion aid package, which appears to be now going to the president's desk in the next few days. But they also, the Ukrainians, worry about voices they now hear in the United States Senate and the House who are questioning whether the United States should continue to provide this level of military assistance going into the future. And Mr. Putin may be banking on the fact that Western willpower, not only the United States, but the Europeans, will flag over time in providing that level of military assistance that the Ukrainians will need if they're going to sustain this particular war.
Jeff, the concern in general is that this becomes not just static, but a drawn out conflict where there is no winner. There's just exhaustion, not just in terms of the troops at the front line or feeding the weapon systems into it, but the countries themselves. And I'm including all of Europe. We also have the weight of the fact that Russian energy is determinative for the economies of Europe, and in 6 months it will be getting cold. So right now, how do you measure this conflict? Can it be concluded quickly? Because everything you've taught me says, no, this could go on for another year or more.
Yeah, I don't see any short-term negotiated settlement, John. I see two possibilities. Mr. Putin now trying to find some kind of an offering. One would be certainly he could escalate. He could use tactical nuclear weapons. He could use chemical weapons. He could escalate horizontally. and perhaps do a cyber attack on the United States or one of our allies. He could try to instigate a problem elsewhere, Moldova, Georgia, someplace else. Or he could now decide he's secured Mariupol, he's secured the land bridge for Russia proper to Crimea, and he could suddenly announce a ceasefire. We have now punished the Nazis, it might be a phrase he might use. We have now secured control of perhaps the, at least a substantial, if not all, of Luhansk and Donetsk provinces. And he could call a ceasefire and call for negotiations, trying to draw the Ukrainians and the West into that same sort of Minsk process that began back in 2014. We then end up in kind of a frozen conflict, as we saw from 2014 on to 2022. I think people forget that, you know, in that period of time, 14,000 Ukrainians died in periodic violence between so-called separatists and the Ukrainian military as we were at the same time negotiating. So moving back to that same type of position while controlling the territory along the Sea of Azov might now be an option Mr. Putin could consider.
One improbable outcome would be Ukraine wins. Does Ukraine now have the weapon systems, the manpower, the logistics to break the Russian logistics and drive them back into, across the border? Or is that a utopian concept that the Russians could be defeated?
I think the only way the Ukrainians can do that is a combination of their fierce resistance, which has been strong, the West's willingness to support that, but at the same time, the Russians' failure to keep their forces supplied to a fashion that they can defend themselves. Clearly, the Ukrainians are trying to do that, and they're making progress, for example, particularly around Kharkiv. But until it could take a significant amount of combat and force to move the Russians out of all the areas they control and push them back at least to where they were on the 24th of February, which would still be, of course, occupying Crimea, which they occupied in 2014, as well as substantial portions in Luhansk and Donetsk, which they had fomented that rebellion in 2014 at that time.
Colonel Jeff McCausland, United States Army, retired, CBS News, Dickinson College. He is the CEO of Diamond Six Leadership and Strategy. The story is also NATO, and there's news about Sweden and Finland and Turkey. I'm John Batchelor.